Hello, I'm Michael Steed from Kaplan Financial, and in this podcast I'd like to deal with something that is enormously important, and that is practice management, how we deal with our own affairs and, most important, how we deal with our clients' affairs. It is, after all, at the very heart of what we do. So what exactly do clients want from an accountant? Now that seems like a very innocent question. It's pretty important. Clients want to know that you are looking after their interests in a positive, proactive way and at a price that they are comfortable with. So it's a crisp, friendly service that they can afford. We've all heard the moans from clients about the previous accountant, and some of the gripes sound really dreadful. I do quite a lot of talking to members in practice as I go around the country, talking about taxation affairs, and some of the stories that get relayed to me are horrific. So they're doing our profession no favours, but at least it gives us an opportunity to redeem our brethren and to shine personally. We live in an age where expectations have never been higher, where personal service is taken as read, I guess, and people are pretty swift to complain if it's not up to scratch. So although our clients' expectations are high, we, of course, need to be realistic about how we're going to meet and to manage those expectations. It would be folly indeed to promise too high and then to deliver too low. So managing client expectations is, in my view, at the heart of a good advisor-stroke-client relationship. The starting point, of course, is the letter of engagement, setting out the duties and the responsibilities of each party. This is an absolute must from every angle, from a job ranging from the smallest tax return or a bookkeeping job to more complicated issues such as a business valuation or a personal tax planning exercise. And I think it's right that letters of engagement should be reviewed at least once a year to test them for effectiveness. Has the client added activities in the to-do list? And if yes, these need to be reflected in that letter of engagement. It really is an important point, and the practice directions from the AAT, in fact from all of the professional bodies, require members to go through this. It allows problems to be dealt with as they arise. If it's not on the letter of engagement, then you've got quite a strong position to negotiate from. If you haven't got a letter of engagement, of course, you're on the back foot. I want to deal with another angle that members in practice deal with every day of their life, whether we should work from home or from an office. That, of course, is down to a range of ideas like personal preference, cost, and so on and so forth. Many AAT members indeed work from home, and when I go around the country talking to them, most of them are pretty happy with that, and the clients are pretty happy with that too. In fact, in a recession, I think there's something to be said for working from home because it comes across as a virtue. That is, your cost base is lower, and therefore your fees are lower. But we all know that working from home is, for some clients, a license to phone you at all hours. Now, when you're starting out in practice, that's probably a price worth paying. But as time goes on, I think it's important to separate your home life from your professional life. I think a practical way of managing this, at least as far as the phone calls are concerned, is to have an answering machine saying something like, "Hello, Fred here. Sorry I can't take your call. My hours are, here's an idea, 8:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. and I'll get back to you as soon as I can." I personally think that the hours that you are available should be a letter of engagement point. It just helps hammer that point home. Now, I know that some of you will think that an open all-hours policy is what makes you different, is your unique selling point. It makes you attractive in the marketplace, but I do think that it can go too far. I think you must find out what works for you and indeed your family, and you've got to stick to it. Now, having a telephone answering machine, of course, won't help the persistent knockers, those who just drop by often with a pretext of giving you some inconsequential piece of paper like a payslip or a statement from their pension. And if this does offend you or your family, then they're going to have to be dealt with politely to say and to remind them that you, like they, require some downtime. You need to go off duty. You need to have some personal time. Now, we'll deal with other aspects of working from home in later podcasts, but I think there's one other angle that we should recognise, and that is that there are taxation aspects to working from home. A dedicated room, some of us do that, a converted garage. Don't forget that for capital gains tax purpose, a dedicated space may prejudice your PPR relief, that's your principal private residence relief. So there is an argument for not having a dedicated space, instead a shared space, an office that also doubles up as a bedroom because perhaps there's a fold-up bed in the corner or a wardrobe in the room. So working from home does work, but you need, of course, to think about planning aspects, whether the council's happy with it, whether your neighbours are happy with it too. Working from an office, I think, is a natural progression. I think there comes a time where working from home is simply too much for the family, for the house, for the space. You've got files in every spare corner, and then you're going to think about having an office. Now, where do you move to? Do you move to a high street location? Do you move to somewhere, a shared office space, whatever? I think this is a matter for you personally. I've spoken to many members who have made that jump, and some of them have done it successfully, and one or two have said that it didn't work quite as well as they hoped. I always think this is one of these networking points at AAT events, and of course we encourage you to talk to each other, to actually share your experiences and to work out what works for you. I want to deal in this part with practice management software. Now, I am not a huge technical guy. I take on technicals as I actually need them. But I've talked to a lot of people about practice management software as I go around the country. And there are a whole range of offerings, CCH, APS, Iris, just to name a few off the top of my head. So what do these practice management systems actually do? Well, as you'd expect, there's a whole range of things. Monitoring risk, that's actually a very important one. It sort of gives you client information, whether they're a VAT client, whether they're a PAYE client, and so on and so forth. Have you got the best telephone number? Information about your clients. They help you analyse staff productivity, give you time and fees, debtors ledger. And something that I confess I'm particularly bad at is a WIP analysis, work in progress, and dealing with aging WIP. I think I must have a kind streak or something because I do tend to let my WIP actually run on a bit and it becomes kind of structural after a while. I suspect that a few of you may sympathise with that position, but if clients are struggling, I sometimes take a kind view that I won't bill them now. I'll perhaps bill them in a month or two when the workflow starts again. Practice management software will also give you a calendar. So, how do I feel about these packages? Well, I'm not going to give you a recommendation because I don't know enough about them. I personally have got a sort of a simple system on Microsoft Outlook, which gives me calendars and so on and so forth. And I use that. And for me personally, I use a big wall planner. I've got a huge wall planner in my office where everything just hits me in the face and it's all color-coded and so on and so forth. And that just works for me. So come the time when that doesn't work anymore, then I will no doubt go completely computerized. So these packages, well, I'm fairly positive about them. Having talked to a lot of people who are accountants, I think once you've made the jump, you sort of tend to feel a bit more positive about them. I think they're especially good if they're integrated into accounts and tax software packages. For example, Iris, as I understand it, actually offers this integration. So, as far as these packages are concerned, again, I think it's a rather personal issue. I feel that MIPS across the country are sort of slowly turning across to them, but there will be many people, myself included at the moment, who are quite comfortable with the big wall planning systems as a way of managing risk. But no doubt one day I will indeed make the jump. I think it's worth emphasising that one of the key features of practice management software is that it is trying to help you manage risk. Risk of missing deadlines, for example, is always close to my heart, and I'm sure yours as well. I've never missed a deadline yet, and I'm just crossing my fingers, but I've sometimes come close to the wire. Does that sound familiar? I think another way of managing risk that I personally find works is having a day book. Now, this can be computerized or it can be hard copy. It's a bit like a ship's log. I record telephone conversations, not the fine detail, that goes in the file note, meetings, letters sent out and so on. It's nothing too sophisticated, but it does give me a good overview, and it helps me order my thoughts to plan my day, and it gives me a very quick record of what happened, and I can look back over a couple of months swiftly to track what's going on a particular client, and I have to say that that works for me. Okay, that's enough about practice management software. Let's move on to other areas. Another area that often comes up in conversation is dress code. Do we dress to impress or do we dress to be comfortable? As far as dress code is concerned, I personally think it's important to get it right. It's often said by marketeers that you don't get a second chance to make a first impression. So dressing correctly, I think, properly reflects our profession and it reflects on us personally. Nearly all the AAT members I meet dress appropriately, and in discussion I think there's a general view that that means a suit for men and for girls something sober but smart, especially when it comes to first meetings with clients. Now obviously if you work from home, dress code can be more relaxed, but for meetings and indeed first client meetings, even at home, I think demands something more than a t-shirt and jeans. Now, that leads me on to client visits at their houses. And again, I think that, you know, reasonably good dressing is needed. It upholds the professional crisp image that you are trying to deliver. Now, we'll talk about meetings and managing meetings in just a moment, but there's something else too. I mean, quite a lot of people, me included, drive slightly older cars, and that's not just a plug for my Land Rover, but just occasionally, I've sort of parked around the corner and walked the last 50 yards so that people don't look at my Land Rover and think, oh my life, if he drives that old heap, he must be rubbish. So I think having a car that, again, reflects what you're trying to do is appropriate. I had a wonderful conversation with a past president of the ATT, in many ways your sister organisation, and he said he had three cars to visit clients. He had a Range Rover, which he visited his sort of upper market clients. He had a sort of a mid-range Mondeo, and he had a slightly old clapped-out car that he used to visit some of his less well-off clients, because he just said that, and I think it's a fair point, that they felt comfortable with him not being overcarred, as it were. I don't think that it comes across well when you turn up in an incredibly swish Mercedes to do somebody's fairly straightforward set of accounts, say a labour-only subby, because it may give them the impression that your fees are too high and they'll start to resent you right from the beginning. So I think cars, appearance generally, it's all part of that sober but professional image that I personally think's rather important. That rather neatly brings us on to marketing and selling. Marketing and selling, what the heck's the difference between those two? I'm a simple man and I like simple definitions. To me, marketing is the preparation for selling. You know, we all have to sell ourselves. When I stand up and do talks, I'm selling myself. When I offer some advice on something, I'm selling myself. And accountants traditionally have not been good at this. You only have to go back to the Monty Python sketch to appreciate that. But we do need to market and sell. Everybody needs to do that. And of course, that begs the question, well, how the heck do we do that? Do we actually need to? Some MIPs that I talk to say, never advertised once in my life. And other people say, well, actually, I do quite a wide range of advertising. I go through yellow pages, local freebies, papers, and so on and so forth. Now, what about a website? Do you think a website is important? There's been a lot of very good work done on websites, and of course you can get website stats, SiteMeter for example, you can bolt on to your website, which will actually give you an indication of traffic. Quite a few accountants, the bigger ones especially, put a lot of sort of simple free stuff on their websites, and they think that that's sort of background badging, as I would think of it, so they're not giving too much away, but it actually draws people in. There will be those cynics that say, actually, that's pretty much a waste of time. You know, the only real way of getting work and the best way of advertising is by word of mouth. And I think there are many MIPs that would agree with that, that the referrals, the phone call that says, oh, you already do Fred's stuff, he's very pleased with you, could you have a look at mine because I want to change my accountant, or I've been talking to Fred down the pub and I'm starting up myself and he recommends you. Now that is free. It's the very best form of advertising. and it's part of our professionalism. But it is important, I think, to consider at least a website. Is it essential? I personally think that if you're working from home, and maybe depending upon your client base, it's not that essential. As you move up, I do feel, and again, I'm just being fractionally cynical here, that having a website is one of those things that people do. It's not necessarily a very effective use of your time. What else is there? What else should we be considering? What about newsletters, for example? I think they're quite effective, but again, like all of these things, they're pretty time-consuming, as indeed e-zines are. You see some of the slightly bigger accounting practices using e-zines. Email drives are cheap, but they are very time-consuming. I'm quite keen on targeted marketing. That is, you know, I saw this and thought of you, and you've got a sort of a short few paragraphs on something which is specific to your particular clients. I think that's a very important part of client management. So I am a fair fan of that one. And I suppose the last thing that we might just touch on is sector-specific material. So, for example, and in my own area, if you've got new rules, say, on services overseas, or you've got new tax rules for expensive cars, then you're going to have a quick look through your client base and find those that you should send this material to. It's targeted. It takes a little bit of time, but I think that's probably quite effective, and a follow-up phone call. Right, well, I think that's as much as we're going to say on marketing and selling, and I think we need to move on to other things. Right, let's think about staff and staff issues. I think most people would agree that there's a world of difference between working at home on your own with no staff and taking on even one member of staff. And I think for most AAT businesses, that really is a very important milestone and an important decision. Yes, you can expand, you could take on extra clients, you could perhaps buy a block of fees, but you'd need a person or persons to actually help you do it. I think that's the one that would tax most people, and there are clearly a whole host of issues to consider, especially if you work from home. Things like space, are there planning issues? Car parking, do you have enough car parking space? Do you actually want them in your house on a daily basis, from your dining room table perhaps, or a spare bedroom? You have to think about employers' liability insurance, training, the management and the time utilisation of your staff members. And I think it's true to say that not everybody can deal with other members of staff. Some people naturally have those skills and some don't. So you do need to think about that. And if perhaps you're a sort of a sociable loner, you may be better on your own. Now, there are ways of actually closing that gap in terms of managing staff. You don't have to necessarily trust your own instincts. You can go on courses, you can read a book and so on and so forth. But once you've got your staff in place, there are a whole range of new things there. Timesheets, for example. Should you set them billable time? It reminds me of my training with what's now PwC, that there was a huge emphasis on the timesheet. And I have to say that when I left there, I was wonderfully relieved to escape the tyranny of having to record what were then 15-minute slugs of time. But now, in some firms, it's down to units of 6 minutes. And that, I think, is the issue, that once you take on staff, you've got to really think about setting aside a good slug of your time to helping them, nurture them as human beings, to nurture them as professionals. And it really is a time-consuming business. I've talked to many MIPS who have been along this path, and most of them, I have to say, have tackled it very successfully, and they've just accepted that their time, their billable time, is going to go down. They have to spend more time with their members of staff. Now, some AAT members have been extraordinarily good at training people, and there, of course, is a whole new ball game. If you want to train people to do the AAT qualification, for example, you've got to set yourself up for that. It's very, very difficult, very, very time-consuming. And also, I have to say, it's probably a bit like having children, isn't it, that it's very rewarding as well to see people come on, to see them take responsibility. But sometimes you'll have people that won't take responsibility. They're happy just to be set in a corner to knock up a set of accounts and so on and so forth. And you need to be able to deal with all comers. Let's move on and have a look at billing and debt management and something we briefly referred to earlier on, WIP management. And following on from that, managing non-billable time. Now, to me, good billing is all about good communication. You need to communicate the way that you bill with your clients. Do you, for example, do all the tax returns and the accounts and just send out a huge pile of bills, say early in February? Do you do it in stages? Do you put the bill in with the return? I think you've got to set a pattern and very broadly stick to it, but to allow a little bit of leeway to accommodate client needs. So how do you set your fees in the first place? Well, there are broadly two options. You can either go for a time times a rate, and that rate can either be set or it can be varied slightly depending upon the complexity of the work, or you can go for a fixed fee. Now, I personally enjoy being quoted fixed fees. If I go in and ask for a job, maybe I've got a bit of work that needs subcontracting, and I say, how much are you going to charge me for this? I have to say, I get irritated, not to say infuriated, when people will try and slither and slide and say, well, of course, it depends. And I say, well, have a look at it. Tell me roughly what you think that's going to cost. I did that fairly recently with somebody, and they refused to commit themselves, so needless to say, they didn't get the work. I'm quite straightforward. People say to me, how much is that going to cost? And I say to them, well, I think it's going to be between 1 and 2 hours. It's going to cost you X pounds. But don't forget value billing too. If you manage, fairly spectacular example here, but manage to save somebody £10,000 worth of tax, then there is an argument to say, well, I'm going to save you 10. I'm going to charge you 2. So you walk away with 8. But I think the key is communication, as I said earlier. You've just got to be straightforward about that. Once you've got your bill out, of course, you need to be on top of your debt management, chasing your debtors. I personally like a phone call, perhaps a follow-up phone call on the rare occasions that I am not paid. I think a letter then, obviously, is the next thing. You need to look very carefully at the AAT ethics guidelines on non-payment of bills. I know a lot of MIPS have said to me that they manage it, and I think I'm rather a fan of this by having standing orders, direct debits and so on and so forth. I think that's good for clients and that's good for you, especially when you're talking about people like, you know, labour-only subbies who may not be the best folk for managing their own money. I think having something which is set in stone and which beats like a clock, which puts a little bit of money into your account each month, I think that that is a very good way to go. But what about non-billable time, managing non-billable time? We all know that if you've got to look something up, perhaps, or you're doing some training, some CPD, it can just run away with you. And for those, a lot of MIPS working from home, you find yourself working into the evening, perhaps even into the small hours, just to try and get something finished that you know you've got to do, but won't necessarily result in a fee at the end of it. We've already mentioned staff and the way that they can run away with your time that you would otherwise be doing something billable on. And I think we're all agreed that you've just got to try and manage this to keep set times. One of my colleagues actually put set time aside on Friday and says, right, Friday afternoon, I'm not going to do any billable work at all. And I'm just, my door is open to talk about staff issues. People can come and knock on my door. They can talk to me. They can air any problems that they've got. And I will put that time aside every week to deal with staff issues. So these things do tend to interreact. Another very successful friend of mine, he sets up Sunday evening. He has 2 hours on Sunday evening where he says, right, my week starts here because I want to make sure that when I get into the office on Monday, everything's going to work well and I'm ready for my staff meeting on Monday at 8:30 and everybody I expect to be there and we will go through the tasks that need for the week. And then once you've set that up, so you top and tail your week with a Monday meeting and a Friday kind of start area for them to come and talk to you, that is actually a very efficient way of running your week. Okay, so that's something on billing debt management. Let's move on as we head on down towards the end of this podcast to one or two other issues. I think the old sores of stress and loneliness do raise their heads here. Many MIPS, as we know, will be working from home and on their own, and you do need to get out. I think it's very important to have that balance between your work and your life set about right. And we all know, especially when January comes knocking, that we spend far too many hours locked away in our offices trying to meet the deadlines. But you do need to get out. Stress-busting things like going for a walk, going for a bicycle ride, going down the gym, whatever it is, I think you've got to put time aside for it. One person I know is absolutely religious on going to the gym early in the morning, every morning, and he spends an hour in the gym and he comes out feeling fit and ready for the world. He says it's just the best thing that he does. It sets himself up for the day and the rest of his day is hugely productive. So dealing with the stress, you've got to get out, you've got to talk to people. Even clients can be quite good at this. You know, just visiting them can actually give you a break from the home environment. Obviously, as far as illness is concerned, you need to cover for that. You need to set up a locum system and indeed the practice guidelines for all the professional bodies, including the AAT, actually insist upon that point. Okay, so what have we left? I think business expansion is an area that we've sort of touched upon, but let's just try and add a few extra things to it. We've said that there's a sort of a jump to light speed when you start taking on members of staff. But I think generally speaking, growth in business is something that we all need to turn our attention to from time to time. Many MIPS are quite happy sitting at home, having a bit of movement in their client base, perhaps expanding a little bit, one or two drop off because of retirement, moving, etc., etc. And all of that, I think, is part of the natural warp and weft of running a practice. But there is a strategic issue. You do need to work out where you want to be. Some people are very happy doing that for years and years. Some people say, no, I eventually want to take on staff. And there are a very significant number of AAT members who do actually have quite significant numbers of staff. And by that, I mean up to about a dozen people working for them. But then their time is hugely spent in managing that workload. It is, of course, a very personal issue. It's intensely personal. You've got to work out actually what works for you. And certainly, I think it's good for any business. But I run by what I call the four C's. The first C is for compass. You've got to work out where you are going. The second C is for competencies. You've got to have the right skill set. If you haven't got that, you've got to train for it. You've got to keep your CPD up and so on and so forth. The third C is the C for communication. You've got to communicate to your clients. You've got to keep in touch with them. And finally, and it's just my own personal view of the world, a little bit of compassion too. My last C is for compassion. Sometimes you have to spend a bit of time listening to clients, their woes. Perhaps they've got a relationship breakdown that's going to have an effect upon their business. And you just need to sit there and listen to that and perhaps not necessarily say very much. But I think that's very therapeutic for them. And they certainly appreciate that in my experience. Right, well, I think we've pretty much covered all the areas on client management that I wanted to cover in this podcast. I certainly hope to see you soon. We'll be dealing with a lot of other issues throughout the year. So until next time, cheerio.